I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 29th of September. Mondays at 1 o'clock, it's All Things Political, and we're delighted to have Joan Walsh, who's been on this show several times, in our studios in Milwaukee today. She's editor-at-large for Salon. She's a frequent MSNBC commentator, and she is our guest for All Things Political. First Lady Michelle Obama and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie are in Wisconsin today campaigning for Mary Burke and Scott Walker. The president, in commenting on the continuing strength of ISIS despite the air assault against them, says they are a lot more capable than intelligence forces thought they were. Should there be a public scrutiny of what our plan is? Joan recently wrote that President Obama's doctrine of presidential power has much in common with Dick Cheney's. We'll look at Eric Holder's complex legacy, African-American men being killed by police, and the president speaking of community distrust of police. The chances of the Senate turning Republican, and we'll reserve, please bear with us, just a minute at the end for the baseball playoffs. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Joan is the author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. She's editor at large at Salon, and she has a lot of Wisconsin ties. She went to high school in Shorewood and college at UW-Madison. And Joan, how nice to have you in our studios. Hi.
Kathleen, it's so much fun to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. We'll talk about the First Lady's appearance just around the corner in a moment. But let's begin the program with what we're doing in Syria and Iraq and the president's comments. You know, we're trying to find people who understand the intelligence, and it would appear to me from reading all of this that we don't really have a firm grasp on who this group is, how strong they are. What's wrong with our intelligence on this?
Well, it is really worrisome. You know, the president's comments, on the one hand, I always want to applaud when somebody actually tells the truth. And so he did admit that it was a big intelligence failure. So that's good. I don't want him to be penalized for telling the truth. However, it's extremely worrisome because the same intelligence that didn't get that right is the intelligence that's trying to help us find these moderate Syrian rebels, right, you know, whoever they're supposed to be. And, you know, I think there's a lot of concern, for example, that they were kind of hyping the threat of this group, the Khorasan group, that none of us had ever heard of two or three weeks ago. Suddenly they're a big threat. Now they're backing away from whether they're a threat. The intelligence officials often on the record are kind of disagreeing with each other about what that means. So it really is, you know, whether you're pro-intervention or whether you lean against it or you're tending to be skeptical, as I am, I think this is one thing that both sides can be united around. We don't have the intelligence to really tell us what's going on there and therefore what we can do about it.
And we also don't have this full public debate because Congress, it would appear, would rather be campaigning right now than having a public scrutiny of what our plan is and what we're doing right now. Are they more concerned about re-election?
Of course they are. I mean, I find it shocking. I mean, not shocking because it's hard to be shocked, but it really is, it's a terrible abdication. You know, again, whether you're pro or anti-intervention, you should be there. You should be debating it. There's nothing more important than this decision to go to war. And you've got particularly the House GOP, which wants to sue the president over, you know, what they say is abusive power in postponing, you know, one piece of Obamacare, right? He's a tyrant. He's a madman because he postponed a tax for a year. But they're fine with him going to war without their say-so, as long as they can campaign. I mean, you know, it's obviously some people in both parties have spoken out against that, but nobody's really leading the charge to get back in there and vote. And John Boehner's, you know, perfectly happy to let them be cowards. He sounds more hawkish than the president. That's worrisome. But one way or another, it's not right this minute about what we should do. It's just, it's pretty clear that they are supposed to be voting. And the idea that this can wait, they're not even saying, okay, we'll come back, you know, after the election. Some of them are saying we've got to wait for the new Congress to be sworn in. Whichever way that goes for the Democrats or the Republicans, it's maddening. It really is part of why people are fed up with politics. I hate to say that as a political junkie, but it's true.
Do you think that this requires congressional authorization?
I do. I can't. I don't. You know, that's where I really think, you know, it's I hate to use the C word, Dick Cheney, but it is very, very chilling. The similarities between some of the ways that they've invoked presidential privilege and presidential power. There's just no way, in my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of legal scholars who matter more than I do, to stretch either the authorization in 2001 or 2002. One of their really unbelievable justifications is that while the authorization to use force in Iraq obligated us to secure Iraq, and therefore we have not finished that job. That job will perhaps never be finished. So the president, whoever he or she is, can go back in for time immemorial to, you know, secure Iraq. I mean, it's really stretching the boundaries to the breaking point, and I think everybody should be concerned about that.
I always wonder about intelligence in this part of the world, because we heard for so long after 9/11 that we really understood the intelligence. We got rid of an incredible number of al-Qaeda members, and now all of a sudden this other group appears and has this incredible threat in the region, and some would say to us, I don't know if that's true or not. It just dumbfounds me that we didn't seem to see this coming.
And then suddenly we have to go to war, you know?
Right.
I think it's very puzzling, given how much money and time and how, you know, in my opinion, laws that are probably broken to detain and get information out of people. That they couldn't see this coming in some fashion. And I also, I worry, frankly, you know, the beheadings are appalling. But there's nothing about the beheading of those two wonderful journalists that taught us anything new about the capacity of ISIS. They now have the medieval technology to behead people. Shocking. You know, they're cruel enough to use it. Not a surprise. They have video. We knew that. There's nothing that it doesn't really pose any kind of new threat to us. They didn't come to our shores and snatch these men. These men went there, you know, bravely risking their lives, knowingly risking their lives. So the way that that has changed the equation is worrisome. But also it's as if they don't think it's enough to have the specter of beheadings. They have to now invoke imminent threats and the Khorasan group and the capacity to strike here. And, it's really not something I would have expected to see under this president.
Well, what is it that happens? Is it that they're seeing all this daily intelligence, and every president since George W. Bush is going to have to faces the worry that this could happen again, and it simply can't happen. So they think, well, we have to go after these people, you know, and maybe overreact to the whole thing because this will not happen on my watch.
Right. I mean, I think that that is what they, each and every one of them, says to themselves, and you and I would say it to ourselves if we were in their shoes. And I think they probably see terrible, terrifying things periodically. You know, I take that for granted. I really do. And yet, I think there's also clear evidence that our overreaction or our muscular reaction over and over creates new enemies. And, you know, ISIS wants nothing more than to be drawn into a head-to-head, one-on-one, mano-a-mano conflict with the United States so that they can be battling the great Satan, which is now going to war against Islam. And we don't want that. And I think that we've seen over and over the blowback caused by our intervention, whatever its intentions, whether good or bad, even if good, does succeed in creating more terrorism. And it's not to say never use military force, but there's just a way in which we seem to fail to learn the lessons of what happened before. And the rhetoric now is so familiar, and the lessons of getting into the war in Iraq in particular just don't seem to have been adequately learned.
First Lady Michelle Obama is in Milwaukee. Governor Chris Christie was in Hudson, campaigning respectively for Mary Burke and Scott Walker. You're going to hear her after you're off the air here. Is there a lot of national attention on this race? And let's start with that.
Yeah, I think this is a big race nationally. I think that, you know, Scott Walker has become a kind of surrogate for the public face of the backlash of 2010 and what happens when Democrats don't vote or don't vote in adequate numbers. And so the assault on unionization rights, on public workers in particular, a lot of people, you know, got invested in the recall, which probably with hindsight was not, you know, the best decision to recall somebody for something other than criminal misconduct, which, you know, that was not the issue there. But, you know, I think that people see him as very, very vulnerable. And when the Koch brothers got together in June at their annual retreat, Americans for Prosperity and other, you know, Koch donors were very invested in this race. So we know it has a lot of symbolic power on the right. And, you know, it can be shocking to people in Wisconsin, but Scott Walker is still mentioned as a possible 2016 presidential candidate. Obviously, he can't do that if he loses his race now. So for lots of reasons, I think it's seen as a real showdown between two visions of the country.
And should he lose this, and the polls are very close, and he's actually ahead in the latest polls, right. So it's going to be a very close race, I think.
Yes.
But should he lose it, would it be based on jobs in Wisconsin? Would it be based on the economy? And simultaneously, if she should win it, what would that be based on?
I think if he lost, it would be largely based on the economy and based on the perception that he made a lot of promises. What he came through on was, the assault on unions. I think there's that. I think there's also a sense, as I talk to people, that there's a certain kind of fatigue with how polarizing he has become. Certainly Democrats are polarized. There's not a whole lot of independents or non-committed people here. The last 4 years have really force people to choose sides, but there's a fatigue with that. His latest salvo on drug testing welfare recipients, I mean, he just really goes to the hard right option, you know, when he's a little bit vulnerable. I think the thing that's been hard for him and good for Mary Burke is that he hasn't been able to campaign against Milwaukee. You know, it's that there's really a tradition of Republicans campaigning. It's Wisconsin against Milwaukee. She's not the mayor of Milwaukee. He can't do that to her in the same way. And so she's been able to start fresh and largely define herself. That may be changing, and that may change more. A lot more money is going to come in to this state in the month to come.
Oh, really?
I'm always here to tell you things you didn't know.
I wonder how much more money. Let's talk about the Senate. I was surprised to see the Des Moines Register poll yesterday that shows that the Democrat who's running for Senator Tom Harkin's seat is pretty substantially behind in that race. It's either an outlier poll,
right,
or it's an indication that maybe the Republicans are going to pick up the Senate easily.
Well, I don't know about easily. It's an outlier poll, which does not mean it's wrong, but it is showing a bigger gap. He may really have fallen that much behind in the last couple weeks, but other polls show it very close. So we're going to need to see more polling showing that kind of gap. He hasn't run the best campaign. She hasn't either. So it's really one of those things where I think it's going to come down to the turnout of the two bases. And Democrats are well organized there. I think it's going to stay close. I'm not really my opinion about all of this isn't changed by that poll. There's a lot of chatter on Twitter today that's really decisive. People are always looking for that moment where they can predict everything, right?
Right.
We don't want to wait until election day. A lot of people put a lot of pride in being able to tell us what's going to happen. I'm not really one of those people. I don't want to be stupid about it, but I'm kind of like, I think it's still too close to tell you, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to have to wait and let people vote, and then we'll talk about it.
And in terms of the Senate, it's looking like it might go Republican?
It very well could. You know, a lot of things would have to break their way, but they could, you know. And it's a little bit worrisome that, you know, so many Democratic hopes are now pinned on an independent in Kansas. And conversely, the entire Republican, you know, spectrum from Sarah Palin to Jeb Bush have flown into Kansas to try to pull that out for Pat Roberts. That's kind of crazy for both parties that it would come down to something so fluky in such a red state. But, you know, it is. It's that every one of these contested races is coming down to the wire. And there, you know, there'll be a week in October, I promise you, where there'll be a bunch of polls breaking for Democrats. And, I'll try not to say that that's significant at that point either. There's a lot of it's a polarized country, and we're talking about a lot of purple and red states in particular. So, you know, the purple states can go red in the years when Democrats don't vote in those midterm elections. 2010 was a disaster. I don't think 2014 will not be the disaster that 2010 was, but could be bad.
Police actions, killing of African-American men, you wrote a very moving piece about that a couple days ago. It's obvious that police departments in many places in this country need some training.
Well, you know, yeah, or they need different training, because what I wrote about the other day, which was so shocking, in the case of John Crawford, the man with the toy gun shot and killed in a Walmart in Ohio, just 12 days before the local police department was trained, and they were trained on how to handle a lone armed shooter. And they were really coached in our response used to be contain the shooter and wait for backup. And now our response is engage him. And by engaging, they don't necessarily mean waving and saying hello. There's a lot of witness testimony that there was kind of simultaneous drop your gun and shooting, you know, and the grand jury made it, I think, a bad decision not to bring any charges. It's a defensible decision, though, when you read this PowerPoint that these guys were trained with, because it really, it didn't say this, I don't want to misrepresent it, it's bad enough if you read it, but it effectively said shoot first and ask questions later. And it showed pictures of the kids at Sandy Hook, and, you know, really putting the onus on action, not question, and not safety. You know, how do you have a situation where only one person, someone is allegedly menacing shoppers, pointing his gun at children? The one 911 caller did say he was pointing his gun at children and later at the police. It's a full store. No one is calling in. No one is saying there's a guy here shooting. There's a guy here pointing a gun. People are going, if you see the surveillance video, people are going about their business. Only this one crazy guy, I shouldn't say crazy, this one guy with questionable judgment decides that he calls him a black gentleman, and he's walking around pointing the gun. He's here to rob the store or shoot people. And it's a toy gun. And, you know, in a different situation, the police should really be coming in saying, we have heard no gunshots. We have shoppers going about their business, and we have one guy claiming that there's a threat. Right. So it's not merely lack of training. It's that training has really turned toward a much more aggressive posture. And, you know, yes, it's important to really act when people are being shot. Absolutely. But the burden of proof has totally turned around, and now there's a death sentence for shoplifting in Ferguson with Mike Brown, and there's a death sentence for merely carrying a toy gun in a Walmart. That's not the way it should go.
We'll speak more of Eric Holder's resignation in a moment, but the president spoke last night or Saturday about this distrust, this profound distrust between particularly African-American communities in the police department, which is something you just can't have continuing, can you? Because you have to feel that the police are on your side. They're protecting you.
Right. And I think this has been a problem for a long time, but it's obviously getting worse. And the situation, you know, the situation in Ferguson, the situation in Beaver Creek, Ohio, the actions of the police indicate that they are not looking at law-abiding African-Americans as their partners in the community and people who are all in this together, because none of us want any kind of crime, especially not violent crime. It really is that many of them, I don't want to say all, but many, seem to see themselves as an occupying force, and that these people are, they're all suspects. They're not, they're suspects until they're proven otherwise. And it erodes everything you need for good police work. It erodes all the trust. It erodes the capacity to let the police know what you're seeing. You have a situation, and people have talked about this over and over, middle class, upper middle class African Americans who say, I see a situation and I really hesitate to bring the police in. If I see a young man in my neighborhood who, you know, is acting shady, I want to be able to call the police and get some help or get some advice, but I'm not going to because I don't want this young man to be gunned down, or I don't want him to be brought into the criminal justice system unfairly where his life chances then plummet because we, you know, we do such a really effective job of channeling young black men from, you know, from school to prison. We've just got a really great system for doing that, if that's the point. Works very well. So you really, you erode the entire community's faith. And I shouldn't just say African Americans. I think that as a white person that, you know, I pause because I really don't ever want to overreact and set a situation in motion where you report something, you turn out to be wrong, and that person somehow gets trapped in this system, or, you know, worse, hurt or killed.
Joan Walsh is our guest for All Things Political. We'll start taking phone calls momentarily. She is editor-at-large at Salon. She's a frequent commentator on MSNBC, author of What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. You can comment on what we've already talked about, the strength of ISIS despite our airstrikes against ISIS, and whether or not Congress needs to come back from the campaign trail and vote to give authorization to our military action. Eric Holder's resignation, we'll get to that in just a moment. Joan writes that his legacy is going to be as complicated as the man that he served, which is interesting. The shooting of African-American men since Michael Brown and the relationship between black communities and police departments. We're talking also about, we're getting fairly close now to the gubernatorial election in Wisconsin. Today, First Lady Michelle Obama is going to be in Milwaukee speaking on behalf, of course, of Mary Burke, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is in Hudson with Governor Scott Walker campaigning for him. What do you think about where that race stands at this moment? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we just discussed, Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, First Lady Michelle Obama will be in Wisconsin today. They're campaigning for Scott Walker and Mary Burke on Central Time. Later today, a political strategist talks about how these events could shape each candidate's gubernatorial campaign. That's Central Time today from 3 until 6. Hour 2 of our program, on the heels of that massive climate change demonstration and the UN's discussion of this issue, we're going to be looking at water conservation and the future of the Great Lakes, which, as you know, is the world's largest freshwater system. We will have two guests with us, the director of the Center for Water Policy at UW-Milwaukee, and we'll speak with Kathleen Dean Moore. She's an interesting woman. She's from Oregon, and she's a philosopher and an essayist and an environmentalist, and she will be with us as we look at the moral issue facing climate change. All right, let's go to phone calls for Joan Walsh. We start with Mark in Elk Mound. Hi, Mark.
I always learned something when I listened to your show, because up until now I had thought Salon.com was a search engine for beauty products, because I had only seen it in this context of, as near as I can tell, this woman is the ultimate apologist for white liberal guilt. And she talks about how blacks seem to have a problem fitting into society now, but is there a possibility that this fantasy world that she has created, where a cop should let somebody point a toy pistol at them and just assume that because the guy is black, he must be crazy, and the gun isn't loaded? There's this fantasy world out there where, like, I'm not sure where she has been for the last possibly 5 years.
Joan.
I've been here in the United States. Fantasy world, please go watch the Walmart surveillance video. It shows that the young man never, ever, ever pointed the gun at anyone, let alone at the police. He was shot before he could even drop the gun. It was clearly to other shoppers a toy. That's not fantasy. That comes directly from the video. That's not commentary. That's what the video tells us. So,
and it's an indication that call of the division between communities of different racial backgrounds as well, you know, that he would say what he just said.
Yes. Well, he doesn't speak for all white people either.
Right. Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. I want to talk about the police stuff too. I've already told the story on your show about how I had parking tickets I couldn't afford to pay because I was applying for disability, and I was arrested and they sent 7 squad cars and a paddy wagon over to my house and confiscated my dogs and stuff. But I'm not going to go there, but I want to tell you what the arresting officer, who was a woman, said to me. She said, "You need to go out and get a job." And I said, "I'm sick, and I'm in the process of applying for disability." And so then she asked me what was wrong with me, and I should have told her it was none of her business. But I told her, she said, "Well, that's not that bad." And then I was arrested. This is not so long ago.
Chris, you got to get to a point here, please.
Okay. I had another conversation with another police officer who told me that people who are in the position they're in society deserve what they get because they did something to deserve this. And I think that there's a culture in the police system that people have moved from being helpful with society, and they've decided that they are the great levelers. They're going to punish everybody who's at the bottom and everybody who's sick and hurt.
Well, I don't think all police officers feel that way, but there are obviously gaps in the training system. I don't know if you saw the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article yesterday by Meg Kissinger, she's a fine reporter, that you don't have. There are obviously people with severe mental illness that police are dealing with all the time and don't evidently have the training that they need to keep from shooting somebody who is obviously very mentally ill.
Right. So, well, I think your caller makes a good point in that I think we are criminalizing poverty, and that's true for poor white people. We're criminalizing mental illness. We're dealing with a lot of society's problems through the criminal justice system, not through other systems. And so police, to be sympathetic, you know, I have cops in my family, and I have friends who are police officers. Literally, I do. You know, they certainly aren't all that way. But I do think that there a fatigue sets in where they're constantly asked to deal with these problems that the rest of society are punting on. And they do get jaded. But the issue of people with warrants who can't afford to pay them and then who are, you know, again, it's criminalized and they wind up going to jail and they wind up in the system and they can't get a job because they have a record and so on and so on and so on. That spirals out of control and it makes poverty something that people can't, you know, it's just harder and harder to escape from because of all of that.
Yeah. Let's move on to Eric Holder. His complex, and I think that's an apt description, legacy, civil rights hero who defended the national security state.
Yeah, I am a great admirer of Eric Holder for most of what he's done. I think he's been incredibly courageous on civil rights. I happen to be a civil rights liberal, and so when he called us a nation of cowards, I didn't really think he was wrong. It was impolitic language. I think he has been the president's conscience on issues of police abuse, and you know, has made the Justice Department a stronger force in that area. Certainly, he's done what he can do, even as the Supreme Court has cut back the powers of the Voting Rights Act, the reach of the Voting Rights Act. He has made, you know, enforcement and creative and aggressive enforcement of the Voting Rights Act a real priority in a way that it hadn't been. Those are all really important things, but I do think that he's been somebody who's defended the growth of both the national security state and, you know, the Obama doctrine of presidential power. So he signed off on warrants for journalists' records and signed off on a particular theory that this journalist was possibly a criminal co-conspirator because he was willing to publish leaks that they consider illegal leaks. Novel, you know, Nixonian approach to power and to criminalizing journalism. You know, I don't think he was as tough on the banks as he maybe could have been.
I was going to bring that up.
That's certainly another contested part of his legacy. He, you know, was somebody who came out quite quickly and told us why the Khorasan group, as we were discussing before, that we'd never heard of, was somebody, you know, were people that we needed to be very afraid of. You know, I didn't really like seeing him use his credibility, especially with the liberal base, the democratic liberal base, the civil rights liberals, and Bates loves Eric Holder. And so when Eric Holder, you know, tries to corral people to get behind this little war we're about to have, you know, it's kind of effective. People who might resist otherwise, you know, they trust Eric Holder. So, you know, it is definitely a mixed legacy. On the other hand, when I think about who they're going to be able to get confirmed to replace him, I think, you know, many of us who've been his critics periodically will likely miss Eric Holder and miss his passion.
What about the banks? Was it under his purview to take them on? I always wondered why the banks were, after all the money they took from Americans and what's happened as a result of that people have never been able to make the money back, and
yeah,
you know, it's been hard. Why didn't somebody take on the banks?
I really don't know. It could have been something that he carved out for someone in
yes.
his office, and
yeah.
you know, and they did bring some actions, and they did get some minor fines, but you know, even the fines that they got were reduced, and it's just a drop in the bucket, and nobody made that. You know, the way that he made voting rights real and made the you know, the violation of voting rights an outrage to the Justice Department, he really could have done something similar for economic rights and for the rights of lenders, and you know, to speak up and articulate that doctrine as well. That could have been very powerful, and he didn't. And I think, you know, that will be judged as something that, at least by liberals, that he could have done more on.
Mm-hmm. I like the line, too. His legacy is going to be as complicated as the man he served. Obama's going to have a complicated legacy, too, isn't he?
Well, he is. As somebody who was elected, you know, partly, and I think largely, over Hillary Clinton because he opposed the Iraq War, I don't think a lot of people expected that we would still be as bogged down as we are, and I don't think people expected his approach to civil liberties and national security. And so, you know, I think we will look at him as having done a lot of great things, but that will be an area that people will be debating for a long time.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Steve, are you there from Danbury?
I am here. Yeah,
hi,
great
Steve.
Guest, Kathleen.
Thanks, Steve.
I don't know if it's an indication of his desperation or that he just hasn't been reading the news, but I would think that Governor Walker's bringing in Chris Christie would certainly be more of a liability than an asset after Bridgegate. Wanted to hear what your guest had to say about that.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, it's a good question, Steve. I mean, I'm not sure he's a liability, but I don't see how he's an asset. You know, at the very best. He's a guy who has not, Chris Christie I'm talking about, has not really stood for anything besides Bridgegate, even if you don't think it's a big deal. There's nothing that Chris Christie is crusading into Wisconsin, you know, bringing crowds and respect and adulation. He doesn't stand for much of anything at this point, except somebody who's, you know, fighting his own ethical battles at home. I don't see that he really revs up the base, you know, and if you think of the base as being a lot of social conservatives, Chris Christie isn't really that popular. You know, if Chris Christie runs for president, if he survives Bridgegate and has a viable candidacy, which I don't think he does, but some people disagree with me, if he does, he's not going to be the candidate that is the choice of the base. So I really don't see how it helps Scott Walker. It's just a very strange pairing, and it lets the national press corps make a lot of jokes about these two guys with, you know, sharing all over Twitter that there's a really great picture of them talking kind of confidentially. It's like, you know, sharing tips about what their lawyers are telling them and, you know, how to raise money for your legal defense fund. And that, you know, that's a little unfair, but I'm sorry, I'm a Democrat. You know, so it's just a weird choice, you know, in a race as close as this. I don't really see what it gets him. Although I should add, he is raising, Chris Christie's raising a lot of money. And, you know, Scott Walker wants some of that RGA money. Scott Walker is a big priority of the Republican Governors Association. So, you know, he's got to have Chris Christie here. I'm not sure that personally it does him any good at all.
Well, what's with Bridgegate? It's been out of the headlines. It was every day for so long, and then we just haven't heard much. There's a federal investigation that's still underway?
It's still underway. There were some, you know, there were some leaks recently that Christie is not personally the target necessarily, which people sort of some conservatives interpreted him as being exonerated. I mean, it's going to be a very tough thing to campaign on that a bunch of my closest aides did something that is still under criminal investigation and did something that stinks, the little bit that we do know about it. You know, you've got Port Authority police begging to be able to reopen the lanes. You've got all this testimony now about the human suffering that it caused. And the best you can do is say, I didn't know about it. I mean, I don't know how you run for president on that. So, you know, he's not out of the woods, but it hasn't, you know, it certainly, nothing has come out that definitively ties him to being behind it or even necessarily knowing about it. He knew about it earlier than he admitted. He got up and he made jokes about, I was the guy out there moving the traffic cones, when he already knew something was wrong. So, you know, it's always going to raise questions of judgment. At best, he's a crummy manager, you know.
Thanks, Steve, for your call. 800-486-8655. Eric in Madison. Hi.
Well, how are you?
All right, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing well. A question for you, for your guest. I was just wondering, doesn't it seem a little disingenuous that the upper half of the American electorate, the top 50%, who have done fabulously well in Obama's economy and are predominantly white and predominantly anti-Obama, I mean, they've done very well in this economy, and they're opposing him. Doesn't that seem a little bit disingenuous and dishonest? I mean, what is it exactly this upper 50% want? To make even more money than they have? to be even greedier than they've been over the past 6 or 8 years?
It's a really good question. You know, the stock market is soaring. He did not go after the banks. He did not go, you know, he saved capitalism. He saved financial capitalism. It's not just that he saved capitalism, but he saved the system that you know, a lot of us, the particular form of capitalism where the banks control the economy to a large extent, he saved that for them. And he said something once about fat cats, and they got their feelings hurt, and they hate him. But, you know, the stock market surges, the recovery is more than complete. We've never had a recovery where the top of the economy took all, you know, 90% of the gains, and the rest of us got so little. It's as though it were engineered to protect oligarchy and to protect the wealthiest. But they hate him for it. And it's a very complicated story, but they really fear, you know, any kind of government diminution of their absolute power. And they really believe that he represents forces that are that they can't control. And it's very sad.
I don't understand that the issue of everybody struggling and not making as much money in real terms as we did 20 years ago seems to be people working all these jobs. It seems to me as though that's still a real issue, Joan, in this country. And nobody seems to be, except for Elizabeth Warren, addressing that. It seems like it's so ripe for political discourse.
It really does. You know, the New York Times did a profile of that poor young woman who was working three jobs and sleeping in her car and fell asleep and died of exhaust fumes. And, you know, it's just so tragic and really struck a chord that we know who she was and that she worked in three different Dunkin' Donuts franchises. Hmm. And how many stories like that are there? I don't understand it entirely, Kathleen. I really think that, you know, there's a lot of shame in this economy over how hard people have it, and they're not externalizing it, they're internalizing it. And there's a real, you know, we talked about this when my book came out. You and I had a great conversation about it, that they're really, you know, government made a decision to create a middle class after the war, after World War II, mm-hmm. and after the Depression. There was a real society-wide, bipartisan largely, effort to build public universities, and, you know, tax rates were very high, and union power was strong, and a lot of decisions were made by politicians, by government, to shift the balance of power just a little bit. It was still a great time to be rich, and rich people still had a lot of wealth and power, but to just shift things a little bit in favor of the little guy. But I think that people forget that that was a decision that was made by society, and it wasn't just, you know, the smarts and hard work of the post-war generation that created itself. We don't even remember the extent to which government helped do that. And so people, you know, we don't remember the extent to which university educations were subsidized, and I paid $350 a semester at the University of Wisconsin.
Isn't that hard to believe?
It's not that long ago, right?
Yeah.
And that we really thought it was a great thing to expand free or low-cost public higher education to young people. We're not doing that now. We're having debates about whether they should pay, you know, 3.4 or 6.8% interest when they shouldn't be paying interest at all. You know, that should be for professional school. You should really have the right to some kind of college education. We got up to, you know, we K-12. You got to have that. That was in the industrial age. That's what we thought was the requirement for the industrial age. We know that we need a post-secondary education to succeed in this economy, but we haven't demanded that that be something that's funded as well. We just, you know, our social movements and our political system haven't kept up with the changing needs of society, and we're all stuck trying to think about what we did wrong that we can't afford to pay our kids' tuition, and they've got to take out these loans.
Yeah.
We blame ourselves.
Yeah.
Joan Walsh, our guest, and this is All Things Political. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. An excellent guest this hour. Kathleen, I was wondering about the timing of Eric Holder's resignation. I've heard so much about his legacy. But I'm wondering, did anything precipitate this move? Was there some disconnect between he and the president, or did he get a better job offer? Is there any thoughts out there about why he resigned?
Well, there are thoughts and there are theories and there are certainly questions, but I certainly haven't gotten to the bottom of it. You know, he's been saying that he was going to resign for 18 months, so it wasn't a surprise. The timing was a little bit of a surprise, you know, partly because this issue of police shootings that he's taken such a great role in is, you know, it's never been more important. And, you know, we have embarked on a military action that he's been part of defending. So a lot of people were surprised, myself included, but we also had a lot of warning that he would go. And I think I heard some people suggest that maybe it would be easier to get somebody confirmed before the midterms, but I didn't look today at what the schedule is. I apologize, but it doesn't look like they're going to be able to do that. So I don't think that's why. I think they're going to have a hard time confirming whoever it is unless they're just an absolute milquetoast person. So I really don't know. I mean, if you saw his press conference, his goodbye, you know, he was tearing up. It was not, you know, there's no bad blood between those two men. I think that's pretty obvious, although their staffs have clashed. There have been differences of opinion, but I think the genuine feeling between them is strong and real. But he has been wanting to leave for a while, and I assume he'll go make some money. But that's what they all seem to do.
Thanks, Michael. Gary in Friendship. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to throw one in for Obama. I think since the vets criticize Obama for his policies in the Middle East, but he only has left, and at least he's keeping the high-grade crude flowing from Saudi Arabia and Iran. Since Republicans are obstructing and his party, you know, doesn't want to really back him up on any of his policies, what more does he have to do, you know, since he's only got a couple of years?
Well, he probably needs to explain his policies. It would be my response to that. I don't think we've had a full-fledged discussion of what they are.
Do you, with regard to ISIS?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, again, if we were having a vital congressional debate and vote about this, I think there'd have to be a lot more discussion and a lot more laying out of what they think they're going to accomplish. But I don't know. I think that they also play the secrecy card that we're not going to telegraph our strategy. But there's really no evidence to date that they have a convincing and persuasive strategy. So.
Thank you very much for the call. Well, everybody in America except Joan Walsh and Kathleen Dunn were watching football yesterday afternoon, I should say, in Wisconsin. As I should also say, neither one of us happens to be, we're baseball fans and not football fans. You wrote about Roger Goodell. This sport, I'm sorry, but there's something wrong with all the concussions and the dementia and the nature of it, and it's the American pastime and child abuse and spousal abuse and... What are they going to do about it, and does Roger Goodell need to go?
I think he absolutely needs to go. I think he's lied about what he knew and when he knew it. And if there's a tiny chance that he didn't know, he should have known. But this is a man who knew that he had a domestic violence problem and really lagged in doing anything about it. And even, the initial Ray Rice suspension was laughable. The response was laughable. And then he got shamed into taking a response. And I'm not defending Ray Rice at all, but, he may well win his appeals because Roger Goodell didn't even seem to understand his league's own rules about double jeopardy. And, it's just really unbelievable that he would have imposed this weak suspension, then come back and say, okay, I heard the backlash and it is weak and we're going to toughen it up going forward, and then come back and say again, take a third shot at it and say, he lied to me and put all the blame on Rice. And I think that it's not a hard thing for me to walk further away from football. I'm certainly somebody who's paid attention over the years, and sometimes I enjoy it more than others. But, over the last few years, I've felt less comfortable just sitting down and having a beer and watching this stuff, because I do think that they're hurting each other. I think they were, we're paying them a lot of money to kill one another and to have, massive brain injuries that shorten their lives and also lead to violent behavior. So I'm not thrilled with supporting it in any way, even though a lot of my friends still love it. And I don't deny that I may be found on a couch at some point this fall or winter watching a game, but I really have a lot of uneasiness about it.
And then it brought up this other large issue, which just, I don't quite get it, Joan, but this whole idea, we still have corporal punishment in all these states where you can spank children. We still have this idea where you can spank kids, you can hit kids, because that's sometimes the only kind of discipline that will work. The whole issue of how widespread spousal abuse still is in this country, I just don't get it, how people can lash out in that fashion and justify it of people you love. I can't imagine living that way.
I can't either. I know that in my family, my father was hit and made a decision, by his Irish immigrant father, and made a decision not to hit us. And, that happens generation to generation. People can get enlightened and people can figure out other ways of raising their children. So the people who defend it as somehow necessary or somehow culturally appropriate, that, particularly in the African American community, it's allegedly more common. I'm not even sure that it is, but that there's somehow this defense of it comes out of, a desire to protect kids during slavery and to enforce a kind of, immediate discipline, because doing otherwise would put their lives at risk. And yet it's not something that contributes in any way to, good child development. And we see again and again, the kids who are beaten, they do less well in school. They grow up to beat their wives. They grow up to beat their kids. So you've got to stop the cycle of violence, and we've got to stop defending it in any way.
Right. And finally, you get to go to the playoffs. Your team does. We don't.
I'm sorry. I know I tweeted before I came here that I was a little bit relieved that it was at least settled, because I didn't want all my Milwaukee fans to be mad at me this weekend. People seem to have forgiven. The Giants had nothing really to do with what happened to the Brewers, and it was not a pretty sight. But we did the same thing. We started strong. You guys were stronger. And then we caved, and then we came back again at the end, which I guess the Brewers failed to do, but there's always next year. We've got a one game in October, at least. We can say we got to play October baseball, but I'm optimistic that they'll go beyond that.
Do you think so? They're going to win in Pittsburgh?
I think they're going to win.
So why do you love baseball? What's the difference to you in 30 seconds between baseball and football?
George Carlin. You remember that old
routine?
I love
yes.
that routine. Yeah. You're going home. I was raised by both my parents loved baseball. It was
Did they?
The transistor radio on in the house all summer long. That's all I can say. I just still love it.
Yeah. And you wrote a book about it.
I did. I collaborated with the Giants on a book about when they built the park in 2000. It was really a great, great summer.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Thank you so much for coming in the studio. Have a really interesting afternoon. I know you're going to.
I will. I'm heading right over to see the First Lady.
All right. Thanks, Joan. Joan Walsh, our guest for All Things Political. She is editor-at-large of Salon.com. She's from this area. Well, not. She spent a lot of time here. She went to high school here and went to UW-Madison as well. She's the author of What's the Matter with White People Finding Our Way in the Next America, and we thank her so much for being, and you can see her on television on MSNBC.com. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scott Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we're going to be talking about water in this area and the future of the Great Lakes. You know, Lake Erie had that horrible problem in August where there was a water ban in Toledo and some other communities. So we'll look at how they are all interconnected, the problem of water shortage, the problem of warming of the lakes, and what climate change is doing to the Great Lakes. We'll have two really good guests with us and hope you'll join us for that conversation. All of that is coming up right after the news, which you'll hear shortly from National Public Radio.